Hello everyone, and welcome to the Reading Party podcast with Megan and Lexi. Together, we'll watch, snack, and chat our way through books and films set in the ancient world. We bring our expertise as ancient historians to the table to dissect every detail. We hope you'll grab your favourite beverage and snacks and join us every week on this adventure. Before we start spilling the tea, a brief note on our content. The Reading Party podcast is created for adult audiences. The stories of the ancient world are full of violence and undisguised sexual content, and your hosts aren't afraid to curse up a storm. For those reasons, this podcast is not suitable for under 18s, and certain episodes may not be suitable for those living with trauma. This season, we're focusing on stories set in ancient Egypt, and we'll be bringing in guest hosts that are subject matter experts to help us really dig into the history of what we're reading and watching. With that in mind, let's get going. Lexi and I have our teas and are so ready to start spilling the tea on a ton of ancient stories. Good morning, afternoon, whatever time it is you're listening. Hi, this is Reading Party. Lexi, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. I was just telling Megan before we started recording that I'm very excited because if you know me, you know I'm a huge baseball fan. And so spring training is starting or is here, but we've got games starting tomorrow. And so I just invested in the new Cubs spring training hat of 2024 because it's fire. So that is what I've got on this morning. Also, I have a random hat on because I'm hiding some bad hair. So I don't just randomly, you know, walk around my house with a hat on. So it's hiding my hair right now. And I just got myself a nice hot cup of hot chocolate. Because I forgot to plan ahead and I ran out of tea. It's very sad. I am sorry. That will be rectified because I will get tea today.
Hot chocolate is still delicious, though.
How are you?
I'm good. I do not have a hat on. I like hats, though. I don't have a lot of baseball hats, but I have a decent collection of like vintage style cloche hats, which I enjoy very much. And I don't wear them a lot at the moment because the children are of an age where they like throw things off my face. Nora especially enjoys either grabbing my glasses or just smacking me in the face and watching them go flying, which is an absolute delight, as you can all probably guess. So yeah, not wearing hats at the moment, but I do have a lovely cup of tea. I have lemon and orange black tea with a little bit of honey. I discovered a cache of teas that Josh bought me a while ago, actually, and I thought I'd finish them. I haven't. So I'm very excited. It's a good tea.
So I want to celebrate because we've made it to the end of the Wilbur Smith series, book 6, done. And oh man, just, oh baby, there's so much here. So yeah, Megan, do you want to try your best to recap this interesting story?
I will, however, say, and I am not even going to entertain the idea of doing this, but he's actually written more in this series that we had not realized. There are at least two more. There's the New Kingdom and one called Testament. So we have not finished the series. I have no desire to go any further than this book.
Thanks for telling me that he wrote two books in this series that I wasn't aware. Because believe me, after I finished this one in whatever year it came out, 2016, 17, whatever it was, I really did. I thought to myself, okay, well, I still enjoyed it. So I was like, okay, I want to know if he writes more. I don't know how. I always Google his name like every year being like, is there another book in the Egyptian series? And like the internet was always like, no, there's nothing. So, oh my gosh.
Well, I think the most recent was maybe published in 2020. So there was a little bit of a gap, I think. But yes, we will not be reading those. Yeah, I don't think we need to, but
I was happy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I'm happy with stopping here also. And we're talking about, like you said, Pharaoh, which chronologically follows on from Desert God. But like we said, when we talked about Desert God, it changes. Oh my God, it changes the chronology that we've already seen in Warlock and all the other books. And I went back and I did double check the order that they're promoted in,
right? Because you would assume that the order they're promoted in is the acceptable reading order. And we've done it right. We skipped Seventh Scroll, but you're not supposed to read, apparently, Desert God in between River God and Seventh Scroll. And I don't understand why. Like you said last time, this book opens with Pharaoh Tamose, our beloved Mem, dying of old age. Well, not of old age. I think he gets hit with an arrow, but he's very demonstrably an old man. And totally contradicts what we saw, where he is killed as a young man in battle. And a different son entirely succeeds him. A son that we have no idea even existed, called Uteric, who is both evil and insane, and also very gay. And I dislike how those two things are very inextricably interwoven within the narrative of the book. But it follows Taita, as we've come to expect, as he escapes from Egypt because Uteric, for some unknown reason, really, really hates him. We don't particularly know why. It's never explained adequately. Takes Mem's, one of his other sons, Ramses, with him, and they go to Lacedonia, where Sakaar is, and Hui, and the princesses, except they're now king and queen of Lacedonia. And Tahuti is now called Queen Sparta? Yes, let's all just ponder that, which is translated as meaning something like the beloved one, or the most beautiful, or some epithet suitable for an attractive lady. So she's called Queen Sparta. I don't know why. And she has this amazingly beautiful daughter who we find out is actually the daughter of Apollo. Because why the hell not? Why wouldn't she really be the daughter of Apollo? It makes perfect sense. And in kind of a Helen of Troy-esque style thing, she's had people sending their sons to beg to marry her. And she's so beautiful and so gracious that she turns them down. But they go away feeling happy because of the manner in which she refuses them. Anyway. We stay in Lacedonia for a while, and Serena, who is the princess, falls in love with Ramses. Love at first sight, as we've come to expect from this book series. Like, they see each other and that's it. They don't even need to speak. Like, he could be an appalling brute and she genuinely wouldn't care, because she can tell from his regal bearing that he is the man for her. So they fall in love, and there is a whole load of heroic shit that happens in between. Uteric sends his men to try and steal back the ship that Ramses and Taita stole, and they get foiled. But instead of, you know, killing all of them, Serena decides that, well, her father was going to kill them all, but she decides, no, we should spare them, send them home. Which, I mean, really? Why are you letting a 16-year-old girl make this choice? Yes, I know she's wonderfully beautiful and you love her very, very much, but that's just a dumb decision. And Taita says it like, had I known now what I know then, like, of course you know what the hell's going to happen. Anyway, so they sail off, and naturally Serena is then kidnapped by Egyptians and taken back to Egypt. And the rest of the book is taken up with her rescue and then Sakaar, who's called Huotic or something. I'm not good with the whole name change thing. But Sakaar and the rest of his army and all of his like vassal kings, there are 16 of them, the man's doing pretty well for himself, they all go to Egypt and defeat Uteric and save Egypt and Ramses and Serena, who is now Queen Cleopatra. Consider that one. They are now going to rule Egypt, and it's all very lovely and wonderful. And yes, there's obviously a lot in there that I've glossed over, but that's the very basic plot. There's also an interesting kind of underwater tunneling thing going on, because apparently before the Egyptian civilization that we are currently reading about inhabited Egypt, there was a race of the ancients who were like amazing and superhuman, and they managed to tunnel under the Nile. And their tunnels still survive, and they've got beautiful glazed bricks, and it's unlike anything Taita has ever seen before. Yes, and the whole tunnel thing, honestly, was a plot twist that I saw coming from an absolute mile off, which was frustrating. Because there are these four islands that are across the river, and he goes and he visits one of them, and he discovers, oh, it's man-made, and there are these glazed bricks on it. And he visits the other, oh, it's also man-made. I wonder what they were doing. And there's this old folk legend about the ancients being able to cross the Nile without using boats. Well, of course they're fucking tunneling it. Taita thinks there's a series of bridges. Yeah, you know, fair enough. But if there are a series of mysterious islands with no structures that you can see on them, yeah, they're tunneling underneath. goodness me. So they manage to tunnel into the, or use those tunnels to get into the fortress, essentially, and overwhelm Uteric, or at least the soldiers that he's left there. It's not actually Uteric, because the man has a penchant for using body doubles and being very sneaky. So he has to be chased down, and he's found in a leper colony, because of course he is, because he's totally stark raving mad. Yeah, that was a pretty short summary for me, actually. Lexi, what did you think of the book?
Well, I realized quite early on that I remembered more than I thought I did, but also I remember things really out of sequence, and like some of the things I vaguely remembered, like I didn't do justice to in my mind, because I was like, oh, right, this happens, and I thought this was bigger. Things were different, but also like same. So it was a really weird experience being like, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah. Oh, wait, no, what, they changed it? Yes, it was really weird. And it's funny because, I mean, I don't really remember what, I wish I could remember what I thought or felt when I first read this, because I first read it having the physical book. Doing it via audiobook this time was a completely different experience. It's, it really changes it, because if you felt reading it, like the physical copy, that the plot went a million miles a minute, oh my God, audiobook wise, it's like, so, because I was trying to like do laundry and do some other stuff. I was like driving to and from work. And I just feel like I would always be like, wait, I feel like I missed something. Like, I know I didn't, because I've been listening, because the pace is like, you go from Pharaoh is shot and dying, like in the first 5 minutes. At the end of chapter one, he's already headed toward Luxor. And then I'm like, okay, that's really fast. And then by like chapter four, we're a few days into being in Sparta. And I was like, this is really fast. And then, you know, by like chapter 10, you're like halfway through plotting to go rescue the princess because we're back in Egypt. And you're like, oh my God. So it was really fast. And I felt like I was missing things the whole time constantly. And I don't know if it was because it was like audiobook. I don't know what it was, but I think it's just the plot is fast. But within this fast plot, yeah, again, I also kind of was like, let me just make sure that all the info I'm gathering for the background and exposition, I want to make sure I have it straight in my head. And I mean, it didn't just gloss over Warlock. It's like Warlock never existed.
It completely ignores the whole thing. And there are details in there, like Taita being this magical long liver and the language Tenmas, that are both things from the quest that chronologically speaking, Taita hasn't encountered yet. He doesn't know these things even exist, but he's talking very glibly, or his internal monologue is talking very glibly, glibly about being a long liver and having these magical properties. And then he and Serena talk to each other in Tenmas. And I'm like, you don't know this exists.
I mean, so yes, no, the chronology is off, but I mean, it's just, again, if you're going to do a long series, I think every series needs a lore master, which is sad because usually authors are their own lore masters and they're the most protective of their lore. This one, it needs an exterior lore master because, oh my God, the lore is all over, which also just makes for a really shitty read. I'm sorry. Like, can you imagine Lord of the Rings all garbled up? I mean, what if it was like we had the Battle of Helm's Deep before the Elven Council, where they're like, let's take the ring back. And you'd be like, I am quite confused, you know? So I would be like, what the fuck? Although there are moments in Lord of the Rings where I'm kind of like, I know the reasons why, but it's very funny. You know, I'm kind of like, well, why did they have the eagles come when you could have just flown them to Mordor in the first place? Ha ha ha. But that's a completely different thing. But it seems like in Warlock, Pharaoh being a young man, he was killed. An arrow, a Hyksos arrow to the heart or chest or whatever. And he did. He brought that back in where he was like, Pharaoh had been slain because he had been struck by a Hyksos arrow in the chest and it was a barbed blah, blah, blah. And I had to try to get it, but it was fatal. And I'm like, that's great. So what happened? You got that, but his age suddenly magically, he went from being a young man in Warlock to, and Pharaoh was, he didn't survive this arrow because he was an old man of like 90 with white hair. And I'm like, what? But then he like brings in lore from River God, because when he's talking about who, and he's trying to do this expository thing of like who you know, Uteric Turo is and who Ramesses is, he says quite clearly, Ramesses was the son of, oh my God, what was her name? Merikara? No. Oh my God. Whatever her name was from the first book, when they go down into the cataracts, though, like when he said it, like I remembered her name and I was like, oh, so because he describes her as like, Mizar, thank you. Where he's like, oh, Ramesses is the son of his favorite wife, Mizar. And I was like, well, that would track with River God because he's obsessed and must save Mizar. So obviously, like, she's the favored whatever. So I'm like, okay, well, now we're bringing in lore from River God. But why didn't we start with this? Because she was not mentioned in Warlock. I mean, yeah, he mentions either Warlock or the quest, one of the two, that, you know, there was this plague and shit. But he didn't mention in this plague that, like, Mizar dies or that. And also, like, when the plague hit, it was, like, supposed to have killed off all of his, like, favorite children, except for, like, one. So I'm kind of like, so the fact that Taric is 6 months older by a second less favored wife from somewhere else, I was like, well, if you ignore the lore, I'm like, okay, yeah, the man had a lot of wives because he's a pharaoh and he had a lot of children, sure. But this was his eldest son. So I'm like, I was trying in my head to like knit together the lores. And I was like, okay, let me just take Warlock for a minute. Nefertiti was the son. So who's, which wife? And was she not, was she also a lesser one? And was he just one of the younger sons and not one of the older sons? But I was like, you know, this timeline really doesn't allow for me to fit Nefertiti into it. So I'm like, okay, well, I don't know who Nefer is with this being my timeline and my lineage. But also, like, even without the Nefer stuff, like, his timelines for the kings and characters for Hyksos leadership also change, because the two villains from Warlock, who, you know, he makes a big deal, Mintaka's family is the rulers of, you know, from Avaris and whatever, and they're descended from Solitus, for the villain from the first book. And I'm just like, all these names that you're hearing from, and now the Hyksos in the north are being ruled by, none of them are Mintaka's family. They're not anyone we've known. So I'm like, I don't know what chronology you're going off of. I don't know who's in charge. Did Mintaka's family ever rule then? Like, who, what, when, where, why? I think, no, like, I could have maybe fit things in somehow, except for the fact that Pharaoh dies young in one and old in the other. Now, if he had always died at 90, I'm like, okay, is it implausible to believe that maybe his wives were not so long lived, and so he had these younger wives die first, and then this plague hits him and his wives when he's old, and then like they all die, and then Nefer is there for a new wife. Like, I could have maybe made that work, but the fact that you change Pharaoh's age, I can't make it work. I'm sorry. Like, I have tried to do the most brain squeezing thing ever to no avail. So I just let that go. Although I will say, I really like being taken out of Egypt quite quickly, because Uteric Turo is terrible and ew.
The problem I have with it is that the age thing is frustrating, but my main problem is that in Warlock, Nefer succeeds Mem. He's the next king. And he's the next king for the subsequent books. He's still there. And then suddenly, we're cast back in time, which is annoying, but you know what, whatever, I can deal with it. But now someone else entirely is succeeding Mem. And it's just, it's lazy writing. And yes, I just looked it up. There's a 7-year gap in between the quest and Desert God. So yes, understandably, if there's that much of a gap in between two books publication, there's going to be, you're going to forget things. It's natural. But either reread your own stuff or have someone proof it for you for consistency, because this is just annoying. We've already had a story about the next pharaoh who follows Mem. It was a whole book. Like, we know what happens after Mem dies, and it's not this. And having it just is very strange, very bizarre. And it also, like, this consistency thing is present just within the narrative of this book as well. There's one point where the good guys are taking back the city of Luxor, and they say, or Taita says, that Utaric's men have confiscated all of the weapons in the city before they left to go out on a campaign. So there are no weapons in the city. They're out of the city in a giant warehouse, and the good guys go and break down the doors and steal all the weapons and then go into Luxor and defeat the forces in there. But while they're fighting in the city of Luxor, they are joined by the elderly men of Luxor, who remember Mem and how wonderful he was. And they call to their wives to get their weapons from their houses, which Uteric has already taken, but hasn't taken because they managed to get them from their houses. It's sloppy writing and it's irritating. And if there's an explanation for why these old men have weapons, then just put it in there because people are catching it. Or I'm catching it. And if I've caught it, someone else has caught it. And if there isn't an explanation, then why do they have weapons? Come on.
I want to also point out that at least for some of these audiobook reviews, because I, again, look to the reviews like last book. With the last two books, there were a couple people who were actually questioning whether Wilbur Smith wrote this or whether he had another author write it, but he put his name on it and didn't credit like a ghost co-writer or something. Because people were saying, not all, but there were definitely some comments being like, wow, this is not him. Like, this just seems really inconsistent. Are we sure it's still the same dude? Now, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, and I don't think that he seems like someone who would have someone else write something and then not credit them as like a co-writer. So I personally don't believe that it's like a different person. But, you know, I don't know. But I do want to go back and say, as many inaccuracies as there were some things that he got right that I shockingly was very grateful for. Like, so when we're introduced again, you know, we're picking up with a lot of the same cast of characters as Desert God, which I did kind of appreciate, at least for freaking continuity's sake, that this is like, what, 10 years? I don't remember what the gap is between this book and the last book. Was it 10 years? 20?
I think it's supposed to be around 30.
30, that's okay. Well, it's many decades later, but it's still the same people. So yeah, so we have King Herotas of Sparta, which I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty Greek, fine. And you're like, oh, it's Captain Zaras. Oh my God, amazing.
I've been calling him Zakar. God, I am bad with names.
It's fine. It's Zaras, it's a Z. But it's fine. It's a Z. Well, I couldn't remember Masara, and half the time I'm like, Mintaka's name couldn't come to me. So we've got our moments. It shows how memorable certain people are, I guess, to us. But yeah, so we have Zaras, but then Hui is still Hui, interestingly. And Bakatha is still Bakatha. It's only Tahuti who's suddenly Queen Sparta. And you're like, okay, cool. Amazing. Great. Yeah, I enjoyed how as Herotas, also, let me just say, for anyone listening to the audiobook, this narrative, and I want to demand this for many, many things. It's not just this book series or this book by any means, because it's happened in many of the audiobooks I listen to. I want there to be an official pronunciation guide for historical names and places, because let me tell you, he kept calling Sparta the beautiful land of Lacedaemon. And I'm like, oh my God, this is, I mean, I know it's romanticized because there's a C, but it's Lacedaemon, okay? Like anyone who knows Greek.
I'm also mispronouncing it.
It's fine. It's fine. But
that's very generous of you.
So he was like, the beautiful land of Lacedaemon. And I'm like, okay, well, the region is Lacedaemon because that's the historical, you know, seat of the Spartans and it's well known to classics people. And then he butchered so much. It's a different narrator than, so one guy did River God, Warlock in the Quest, and then it switches for Desert God and Pharaoh, so it's a completely different guy. And he was like, I'm sorry, just as a side note, he was messing up names that like the first guy got, like the first guy got almost everything right. There was only like, the only mispronunciation he had was he would say Elephantine instead of Elephantine. And I was like, okay, that's a really minor thing. And that's like a super nitpicky. I was like, this is fine because he did so well with everything. This guy, he just gets things wrong left. Instead of Tanis, he was calling him Tanis, I think. And I was like, Tanis, Tanis. But he's like, Tanis. And I was like, okay, I hate this. Also, it's clearly Uteric Turo. And he kept calling him Uteric. And I'm like, okay. Okay, this is really, really, really distracting. I'm sorry. I cannot. Yeah. So he was like, Utterick did this and Utterick did that. And of course, he says it with a very strong British accent. So it's even more hilarious because I'm like, oh my God. So a lot was wrong. So let me just go on record and say, yes, as a classicist, I could not stand all of the Greek stuff that he got wrong pronunciation. What? It was like putting a cheese grater over my ears. But pronunciation and nitpickiness aside, for general audiences who don't know or probably don't care or whatever. Yeah, again, back to the things he got right. Lacedaemon, that is the region where Sparta is. And what he got right even then too was the port. He said they sailed into the port of Githio or Githion, which is right. It is the port town. That's the closest port. And then he even got right the fact that he was like, I don't know, in kilometers. He was like, oh, but you know, the citadel, you know, is like 4 kilometers in from the port. So it's a bit of a horse ride or a walk. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. Because in real life, I've been to Sparta. I've been through the Rio Githio. It's like 40 miles inland. It's not close. So I'm like, oh my God, he got that right. Like, this is insane that he's getting like certain geographical things correct. That I'm really enjoying this. Like, you know, and he describes like the lush environment and you have the Taygetos Mountains, which he also mispronounces. He says Taygetos. And I'm like, oh my God, I hate this. It's Taygetos. But it, sure, Taygetos, fine. Clearly I'm not fine over this, but it's okay. I will get over it because I will never listen to this again with these terrible mispronunciations. But yeah, so I really enjoy the bringing in of the Spartans. Again, the timeline is way off because I'm just like, look, man, if this is happening, and even, you know, 30 years between the explosion that wiped out historically Santorini, but I guess in our universe, Crete, like, okay, I mean, even by the time the Mycenaeans take over, like, yes, I guess if we're talking like Trojan War era, Sparta was Sparta. When you mix in all the other people who are very much more ancient, I'm like, absolutely no way. It doesn't track. I don't know. You know,
I think this kind of echoes a lot of the complaints that we've had all the way through the book series, which is whatever research has been done is spotty and very sporadic. The chronology is all over the place. And we have people popping up who don't even exist at this particular time period or have never existed. And then we have a weird like amalgamation of, it's like he's read an historical dictionary or something and just put in whatever appeals to him at the time, which is frustrating when you're trying to root a novel in a specific time and place in history that we have a lot of evidence for. Use that evidence and like properly situate it. Don't just decide, okay, well, I'm going to use the Hyksos as inspiration, but we're also going to have reference to Ahura Mazda being this ancient deity in Egypt, of all places. Like the tunnel is inscribed with a dedication to Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda is not attested during the Hyksos, certainly not in Egypt. And this is putting Ahura Mazda as being far older than the Hyksos presence in Egypt.
You want to explain that to
you? Can't you can't just like take he's a Persian deity. You can't just take random names and random gods and say, oh yes, this can be Egyptian now. I mean, obviously you can do it because he has done, but I really wish he hadn't. Egypt has its own fascinating pantheon of people. Why not just use them? And while we're on the subject, I'm sorry, I'm on a roll now. While we're on the subject, why is Inanna doing her Inanna thing in Egypt? I mean, why is she the daughter of Zeus? We talked about this with the last book, but why is she the daughter of Zeus? Why is she operating in Egypt? And why has she just suddenly replaced Horus as Taita's like titulary deity? The first set of books, he's all about Horus guided my arrow and I'm like particularly affiliated with Horus and I have this affinity with hawks and he's a Horus dude. And now the only mention we get of Horus is when he has to write his name because his hieroglyph is a wounded falcon. And suddenly Inanna is guiding absolutely everything. And don't get me wrong, I'm an Assyriologist. very fond of Inanna, very fond of all the Mesopotamian deities, but it's just weird to have her in a book series and figuring so prominently in a book series set in Egypt about Egyptians. And he's mixing in a whole other bunch of Greek stuff as well. And it gives me a headache, honestly.
I don't even think we can call it an Egyptian series at this point. I mean, come on, we're in like Sparta for a long stretch. I mean, yeah, we go back to Egypt, but how many of these other books were not in Egypt? Like, I'm sorry, like, just don't call it an Egyptian series anymore. There's nothing that's accurate about this historically, really. I mean, at this point, I mean, we knew that from the first book, it wasn't going to be super historic, but I mean, I think it's so silly that we're calling it like a historical.
It's not even need 100% historical accuracy. Just if you're using a specific culture as your inspiration, like, use it and try and do it respectfully. This is just ridiculous.
Well, the other big inaccuracy, which I thought was funny, and I'm like, okay, I guess with the magic you can sort of, but again, just time. I don't know. Like, if you're going to claim certain technologies and inventions are yours, I'm like, okay, fine. That's fun. If you have magic, go for it. Just make sure it's kind of around the same time. Because the thing is, when they're navigating through the Mediterranean, he describes very clearly like the magnetic compass where you have it in the water and it points to, and I'm like, look, man. Mythologically, historically, that kind of water compass, from the research that I've done and read and seen, and maybe I'm wrong, but we would need an expert to confirm this, but I'm not familiar of hearing any of that until Ragnar Lothbrok in, like, when he was beginning his raids in England, so, like, 793 AD? That's when he used that to navigate from Norway to Scotland, or well, technically to Northern England. Essentially, that's what led him to like Lindisfarne to raid. So I'm kind of like, Ragnar is hailed kind of as like the first to figure out how to successfully navigate the open water or whatever. And so I'm kind of like, this is very ancient. We start with the Hyksos, so we're very far back in time. And you want to say Taita invented a water compass that we generally attribute to 793 AD? I'm sorry. Like, tell me he... I mean, the only thing more funny is if they were like, and now Taita invents, I present to you the astrolabe. And you're like, oh, you know...
The computer!
Or, you know, present me with, I'm trying to think, what's another like ancient technology that would completely be, oh, what's it called? It's the Chinese thing, you know, it's like where you, it's the math thing.
Abacus.
Thank you. It's like, yes, I invented the abacus. And you're like, sure, Taita, sure. You know, like, I don't know. I just found it funny that I'm like, okay, now you are Ragnar Lothbrok before Ragnar Lothbrok because you are navigating these seas. You know, I could be wrong. There could be evidence for that kind of magnetic compass before Ragnar, but I'm not well versed in the rest of the world history to know where that might have shown up. But I just find it funny and wildly inaccurate.
In I don't know, said, again, these wax candles as well.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to be charitable and I'm trying desperately, like the last couple books, to find anything positive or nice to say about this book. And I don't want to sound repetitive, so I'm not going to just go with my trusty, it's beautifully written. But also, that's kind of what it's got.
It is very well written, again. And I like some of the characters. I think I like Zaras. He's fun. I like Tahuti. She's absolutely hilarious. Serena is perfect in an uncomfortably boring way. She's like the female version of Taita, except without the weird self-importance thing. She's got some humility to her. But again, the good guys are all good, the bad guys are all bad, and that's how you know which ones should lose at the end. I found it really unsatisfying that there wasn't a reason given beyond, oh, he's mad for Uteric doing or behaving the way he did. Like, he takes Taita into prison almost as soon as he's crowned king, because he somehow knows that his aunts were spirited away or left Minos after They were married to the great, the supreme Minos. And how does he know that? Because no one else knows. The only person who knew that was Taita, and you know he's not told anyone. So it's not explained how the hell he knows that, and it's not explained why he has this massive dislike for Taita, except that, oh, he's insane, which is paired very uncomfortably for me with the fact that he's coded as gay and very effeminate. He's gay, he's promiscuous, all of his male partners are like giggling boys who are kind of goading him into whatever it is he ends up doing. He throws bizarrely deranged tantrums. He's a selfish child. But it's all wrapped up in this negative comparison to Ramses, who is very obviously not gay. He's a man's man, and he falls in love with the beautiful Serena, and he's proficient in the arts of warfare, and he goes out and he drinks. Like, you've got these two characters vying for the throne of Egypt. One is evil, mad, and very gay. The other one is unremittingly good and very heterosexual. And it is just very, very strange. It reminded me of Lord Naja from River God, who is also unremittingly evil and very, very gay. The two very obviously queer characters in this whole series are evil dudes who rape little boys. No, I'm using the wrong names again, aren't I?
No, but isn't he the villain from Warlock?
I'm going to have to Google it now.
He's like the one who supposedly takes over before Nefer comes in. The one who betrayed Pharaoh.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah. No,
Intef, there we go. Intef is, yeah.
I was going to say, no, Intef is the one in River. I believe me, because I was like, that is the book I actually like. That's the book I actually like, so I care about the characters. Yeah, I just want to point out a few things that I think are fun. On the inside blurb of the cover of the novel, there's a quote by Stephen King. And I'm like, oh, okay.
You caught that.
Stephen King, who describes Wilbur Smith as the best historical novelist. And I was like, well, you are clearly not describing this book, because if he'd cared to... I mean, I'm like, to me, that smacks of like an agent being like, can we slap a fancy quote from Stephen King? And you're like, okay, sure. So I just want to point out that that's hilarious. But also, like last time, because I thought it was fun and added a dimension, I thought I'd pull up some of these audiobook reviews. These are really fun. And here's one that I love. It's got one star, and it's titled Not Written by Wilbur Smith. It says, like others who reviewed this book, I can say one thing. It is not written by Wilbur Smith. Wilbur Smith is a genius. I would debate that. But she says, I love him as an author. My favorite book of all time is River God. Read it several times. Love it more each time. Taita is an amazing character. He's a genius, an engineer, an artist, a doctor, inventor, and a poet. He is also a eunuch and a slave. His moral fiber and his integrity are infallible. Capacity to love is boundless. Taita in Pharaoh is but a shadow of the Taita of the other books. Even Desert God was pretty much keeping faith with the overall storyline of Taita's character, although it was not the caliber of River God. Whoever wrote Pharaoh maybe read the previous books crosswise. More probably, he read a summary of the books or someone told him about them. There are so many discrepancies with the other books. And then she lists in a very, very, very long tangent every discrepancy that she was able to find, which are pretty much all the things that we've pointed out, because it is a very long review. But other shorter ones are kind of say the same thing. There's this one that just says, not the Wilbur Smith I know. I've read most of his books, truly loved them. This book was a total bust. Performance was okay. Everything else was like a brand new author who'd never written a book before. I loved River God. I didn't find the magic. And then there's some people who enjoyed it. I mean, there's this one gives it 5 stars. Sad conclusion to a wonderful series. But a lot of them are, you know, 6th book in the series, no good. No action. Worst book of Wilbur Smith. Can't help but feel this seems lazy. Just okay. Did not capture me. So there's bad ones, more bad ones mixed in than any other of the reviewed books. But, you know, there are still people who are addictive story. I'm totally enchanted. Long, but very good. Wilbur Smith never ceases to disappoint. Great novelist. the reviews are mixed.
Yeah. I'm not terribly surprised.
It's still got a 4.3 out of 5 for reviews, though. So I'm like, please tell me who's giving it 4.3. This is like a 1.5 out of 5. Yeah, I'm with the people who are like, huge disappointment. This, that, and the other thing. Yeah. I like seeing what other people say.
Mm.
Yeah. It's disappointing. I don't know. Is there anything positive that you could think to say? I'm just like, I feel so bad that we, like, our whole audience is probably just like, oh man, they're doing this to themselves. And now there's nothing they could say that's good about, like, the last, all the books except River God.
There were fewer weird sex scenes in this one than we're accustomed to, which was nice, I guess. I mean, there was one that was still pretty damn weird that involved Serena, somehow magically lactating on command, which is not, I mean, I hesitate to say it's not a thing, because I'm sure maybe it is a thing for some women, but I've nursed 3 children and lactation is a very specific process. And it's, I don't think, something that generally happens spontaneously to women who are not pregnant or have never been pregnant. I know your body keeps producing milk for years afterwards, but I can't just squeeze my nipple and have, and it wasn't even milk. It was like a clear substance dribbled out. And I'm like, this is a biological unlikelihood. And why is it in a sex scene? Does he know what breasts are for? I don't. Yes, that was annoying. And then at one point, Taita says that now that she might be pregnant because Serena has finally had sex with Ramses, her sole concern must be with the contents of her womb. And I know this is a novel set in the ancient past, and I know that, yes, women, especially royal women, were mostly for making royal babies. But it's just frustrating to read in a book. Like, come on. Find a different reason for her not to go to war, please, rather than she might be pregnant, especially given what's going on in the US at the moment with reproductive rights. It just hit very poorly. So the question was there anything I liked about it? And the answer is very clearly no.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the only circumstance in which I would say read this book is if you somehow soldiered on, and if you're determined to read through all the books, either to get a laugh out of how inconsistent it is, or just see how far down the rabbit hole goes, like The Matrix. Again, it's well written, even though the plot in this one seemed to move a lot faster than the other books. I didn't necessarily have an issue with it. I think I almost prefer fast moving to like slow and torturous. Just, you know.
I did appreciate that the journeys did not take 5 chapters. It was refreshing, actually, that they set out on a marine expedition and arrived relatively quickly.
Yeah. You know, some people have an issue with the pacing. I didn't. It was fine. But, you know, if you're curious just to read through the series, I'd say go ahead and read it. You know, if you've made it through the other books, you'll make it through this one just fine. You know, if you just suspend kind of a good belief in good lore and good chronology, then yeah, you're fine. Clearly, people in this world enjoyed this book. As I said, there's some really great 5-star reviews out there. So clearly people find something to like. I think, let me say this. I see the value, even if this is terrible, terrible stuff. I see the value in continuing to have things produced like this. And I think I'm particularly influenced by the fact that I just finished a book the other day that is narrative history. It's a lot more accurate for sure, but it's a narrative version of history. So I finished the audiobook of The Wars of the Roses by Dan Jones. It's a lot of history because it takes you from essentially the death of Henry V all the way to Henry VIII. And it reads kind of like Game of Thrones because there's so many names and places to remember. You know, I could feel details slipping out of my head because it was just so jam-packed with dates and places and people. And, you know, how am I supposed to remember that this Neville went to war with this Percy? Oh, and then this Percy was killed because he turned coat. And then the next Percy was, you know, imprisoned. But then the next Percy was like freed. So like, it was a lot. But the reason I didn't get lost in this very otherwise confusing book was because I had the good fortune of watching the Starz shows, The White Queen, The White Princess, and The Spanish Queen. And now the Spanish Queen, I'm like, okay, it's Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon. Most people know that. But the first two, it takes you from the reign of Edward IV and the Woodville family. It takes you through all the Neville stuff right into the, like, the White Princess takes you into, like, Henry VII right after the Wars of the Roses. So I had a bad Starz adaptation, which I'm sure was full of terrible inaccuracies, but it made the book not confusing. And I really ended up being so grateful that I'd watched these highly serialized TV shows on these people. Because as soon as we got from Henry VI into, you know, Edward IV usurped, well, his father usurped, and then he became king, and then all the battles back and forth to secure the realm for, like, a, you know, 20-year period, I had the actors in mind. I knew who was who. And so I was able to really set myself. And so I would say, you know, I would recommend this if you've watched those series. And so I see the value because it made me rethink. Like, I'm not a scholar of British history. Medieval history for Britain is so complicated. Oh, my God. And yet I was so happy, so incredibly happy that I'd seen the material because it helped me read or listen my way through the real history to go deeper and get accurate details. Having just had that experience, I'm kind of like, I don't want to completely discount the value of a highly serialized work of fiction gets details wrong, because I guess if it helps you in some way get curious and then you're like, okay, now I want to read about the real history, I don't want to discourage someone from doing and then maybe feeling the way I did when I finished this book. Because let me tell you, I felt freaking fantastic, like amazing, like things just clicked. So maybe that's my positive, which is I think it also made me see that, like, through the experience of really valuing the fact that I had, like, badly serialized TV shows, but I really, it was the key to me understanding, maybe I do have some blinders on when it comes to ancient world things, because I do kind of demand a much higher standard and I do find myself more critical of anything that takes the ancient world. But, you know, if you're not, if this isn't your field, you may feel like I did with medieval British history. So I'm not going to say absolutely don't read it, because if lore gets to you and stuff, okay, don't read it. But I'm just like, if you are a fan and you just want to get some kind of entry point into a history in a different time period, a different characters, locations, names to familiarize yourself, I'm going to be okay with it. Because, you know, if you're not a classicist, you may not know Githio. You may not know, you know, where Sparta was in relation. You don't, you know, you may not know they're kind of far and Sparta didn't really have a port. You may not know the Taygetos mountain range kind of, you know, circles the valley. Like, you don't know this stuff. And, you know, I want people to be interested to learn that stuff that interests me. So, and the same for the mythology. I mean, you know, we talk about how it made a mess of everything, but I guess, you know, if you really want to learn, you just look up the actual deities and then you learn about the real ones. So I don't know. I think my experience with the audiobook really kind of changed things, but I don't know. Final words from you?
I think honestly, historical inconsistencies and inaccuracies aside, I do not like Wilbur Smith as a writer. He's homophobic. He's a misogynist. He's racist. And it all comes through very loudly in all of the books that we've read, especially the misogyny, because taking the fact that this is the ancient world and yes, women generally were property and it's very different, hopefully, experience for most women today, that doesn't mean that you have to write a book where you're constantly fixating on breasts and on women as sexual objects, and on women as impetuous little temptresses who stamp their feet and then defy their father's wishes. No, this isn't the 50s. Actually, that stuff really spoiled the experience of reading these for me. And it doesn't get any better. It's in all of the books of his that we've read. And it rips me out of the narrative. He's a great narrative writer. He's very descriptive. I enjoy how he writes. But every time we get something about Uteric being effeminate and kissing another dude, oh, shock, horror. Or we get something about a woman baring her breasts, I just roll my eyes and rub my head and wonder why the hell someone is writing this rubbish. And I didn't enjoy it. I'm quite glad to not read any more of his work, to be honest, because if I'm going to be spending money buying books, I'd rather do it with people who are not open misogynists. That's my take, really.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to not harp on that because you've covered it very well. And, you know, that's the other thing, right? I think it's decide how much terrible antiquated language are you willing to handle? And I mean, most modern audiences, I would say probably not a lot.
And the thing is, this is terrible antiquated language from a book published in 2016.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, I guess, a little more excusable with the first one. Also, this man started writing in like the 50s. So like, oh, you started writing in that era. Totally understand how or why. But yeah, no, he really needs to update and modernize. I mean, maybe the man who's like, I don't know, he's like 90 now or something. Maybe he's just like, oh, I don't, I'm going to die soon. I don't know. That's terrible to say. But I don't know. I would just say like, yeah, you know, there is inappropriate connotations and it's very raunchy and graphic and violent. And so, you know, if that's not for you, don't read it. If you don't mind getting through it, I don't know. I think just the general is I'm not going to tell people don't do it. I'm just going to say read with extreme caution, with care, and you decide how much of this that you want to deal with. The only book in this series that I will ever recommend is River God. And I know that is also quite graphic and raunchy at times, but for me at least, I've read that book several times, many times. And that one, at least truly being grounded kind of in the history with not a ton of the magic, like no magics. I mean, you got the sort of, he's an inventor of many things, but I'm like, okay, that's his preening main character. Fine. He's just smart. But no, I wouldn't recommend really any of the books in the series now that we've completed five, whatever. But yeah, I would just say, you know, if you want to read any of his work, I would say maybe just do River God and see if you want to continue. Yeah, Megan, are there any books in the series you'd recommend, or just be like, no, avoid this entire series?
Not really. I don't have alternatives, which is unfortunate, but I don't think I would particularly. If you want a novel set in the ancient world, there are better ones. If you even want a novel with magical elements set in the ancient world, there are better ones. War Goddess, we reviewed last season. Fantastic. No, not War Goddess. Wrath Goddess. There we go.
But it's got such a tiny Egyptian thing. I mean, if you're looking for Egypt, yeah, I mean, there
it's
better
options. Egypt, but yeah.
Yeah. There are better options, but yeah. I don't know. I'm very glad we got to the end of this series. I'm very happy that we get to move on to new things. I don't regret taking a look back through, only because I think it was overdue and it was good. If I'd not done it, I probably would still recommend the series because in my memory, I enjoyed it. And so that would have equated to like, oh yeah, it's a good book series, not super historically accurate, but totally read it. And I'm really glad that I was able to, because I've never read these books intending to take a critical look at lore, characterization, writing style, you know, the history I'm always kind of paying attention to, and I knew it wasn't, but I'm glad I was able to have the opportunity to revisit and reassess. So if there's a silver lining, it's got to read all of them again and sort of put them aside and say, thank you for your service. Goodbye.
I'm good.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a shame because I have all of the books in beautiful, like, paperback copy on my shelf in Chicago. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess I won't touch those. But I also don't want to get rid of the books just because I'm like, I like having a whole series on my bookshelf. They'll just sit there and look good. They'll become the world's most ridiculous knickknacks. It's fine. It's fine.
Some people have whole libraries for decoration. I think you can have a book series.
Right, exactly. At least the covers are pretty. That's my good thing. The covers are pretty. Yeah, so I'm very happy to be done. Megan, what are we doing next week?
Next week is our final episode. We are going to be reviewing The Prince of Egypt, 1998 animated movie, with the wonderful Dr. Rose Campbell. A truly fantastic film. I really enjoy it. And it was a good conversation. So you should definitely join us then. It's much more fun, I think, than our conversation was today. There's much less complaining from me, apart from anything else.
Same. Also, it's just one of the best films of all time.
It is great. So join us then. And thank you for sticking with us for this long.
Yeah, seriously, guys. You guys are champs. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to leave us a review. And you can also follow us on social media at The Reading Party Podcast. If you'd like to leave us a book or movie suggestion, then email us at thereadingpartypod@gmail.com. See you next week.